Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn was a researcher and clinician at the Cleveland Clinic in the United States for over 35 years. A highly regarded member of the medical establishment. Yet his nutritional theories about the benefits of an entirely plant-based diet are less mainstream. Famously, Bill Clinton took his advice after heart surgery and says that it's changed his life, maybe saved it. The title of Dr. Esselstyn's book is called Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease. He's in New Zealand to speak at a coronary health improvement conference. And he explained to me the origins of his nutritional convictions.
In the late 1970s and early 80s, my principal duty was chairman of our breast cancer task force. And while I was perfectly content to do the best I could with breast surgery for the women who had cancer, it was increasingly disenchanting to me that I was doing absolutely nothing for the next unsuspecting victim. And that sort of initiated a global research effort on my part to learn a little bit more about the epidemiology of breast cancer. And it was quite striking to find that breast cancer in Kenya, for instance, was 20 to 30 times less frequent than in the United States. And by looking at the Japanese women during World War II and thereabouts, it was very infrequently seen in rural Japan. And yet, as soon as the Japanese women would migrate to the United States by the second, third generation, still pure Japanese American, they now had the same rate of breast cancer as their Caucasian counterpart.
So clearly indicating an environmental influence.
Yes. And perhaps even more compelling was cancer of the prostate. If you look at the data, how many autopsy-proven deaths were there from cancer of the prostate in the entire nation of Japan in 1958? Well, the grand total of 18. That's about one of the most mind-boggling public health figures I think I've ever encountered. But by 1978, 20 years later, they were up to 137 deaths. Well, that still pales in comparison to the 28,000. That we'll see in the United States this year from prostate cancer. So it was getting to be pretty exciting, but at that point I made a decision that might have been incorrect, but I felt that my bones would long be dust before I could do a study on cancerous diseases and nutrition, although in hindsight I think that may have been incorrect. Nevertheless, I therefore felt that we could get at cancer through heart disease because here was the leading killer of women and men in Western civilization, which in part of this global review, it was very apparent that there were many cultures on the planet where cardiovascular disease was then and is even now virtually non-existent because of their plant-based nature.
So essentially, you came to believe that cancer of many kinds, if not all kinds, was caused by the environment and specifically nutrition, but that looked too huge an area, so you concentrated on heart disease. Have I got that right?
That's absolutely right. For instance, today, even today, if you were a heart surgeon and you decided you were going to take your trade to rural China or the Papua Highlands in New Guinea or Central Africa or the Tarahumara Indians in northern Mexico, forget it. You better plan on selling pencils. You're not going to have any business. They don't have heart disease in those areas. They are largely plant-based. And that was sort of the background and what inspired my research.
What does occur to me is to ask you how long people in Papua New Guinea actually live for.
Well, I...
Because, you know, you've got to die of something, and
right.
It occurs to me that their life expectancy may not be that great.
I think that's a good question, but there has been a very interesting study done and to look at the causes of death and cardiovascular disease in the Papua Highlanders who have died, and this was an autopsy study of only those who were over the age of 60. And it's interesting that their principal cause of morbidity seems to be pulmonary. They have a very interesting habit of smoking a very harsh tobacco, which they raise, and they often will smoke this tobacco in these communal hutches. So you not only get your own smoke, but you also benefit from that of all your neighbors. Well, this is given them quite a toll of pulmonary disease, but despite the fact that they smoked this much, when they autopsy them over 60, there is not a whiff of any cardiovascular disease because of what they eat. And this was about 19 different varieties of sweet potato.
Everybody's got their own bad habit, I suppose.
So it would seem.
Ain't no perfect society. All right, let's get back to the basics. A completely plant-based diet, you say, can not only, and this is the title of your book, prevent but also reverse heart disease. What is it about heart disease that is caused by meat, fat, dairy products?
I think that gets right to the heart of the problem, and I'd like to try to go into that in some depth with you and your audience if we can today. You know, it's very interesting that if we look carefully, even at our 12-year-olds in school today, if you measure the carotid artery to the brain, it is already starting to get a certain amount of thickening. And if we survive into the warranty period until we're in our 20s, we now know from the autopsy studies that were done on our GIs who died in combat in Vietnam and Korea, that fully 80% of these 20-year-olds will already have a gross evidence of coronary artery disease that you can see at autopsy without a microscope. And there are some who might say, well, maybe it's just stress of the military. But if you did the same with the Koreans and the Vietnamese, it was only 1% to 3%, not 80%. So, interestingly enough, we now have another study 40 years later, no military, and this was done on thousands of young people between the ages of 17 and 34 who have died from accidents, homicides, and suicides. And now the disease is ubiquitous. Everybody, even at this young age, has it. Not enough to have their clinical cardiac events yet, which are probably still a couple of decades down the line, but there it is already established. We're obviously doing something that isn't correct. So let's look at another interesting observation that where we as a medical community really blew it, and that was in World War II. It was characteristic of the Axis powers of Germany. When they overran the Low Countries of Holland and Belgium, and they occupied Denmark and Norway, they took away their livestock for their troops, that is to say their cattle, their sheep, their goats, their pigs, their chickens, their turkeys, gone. Largely now, these cultures became plant-based during the war years. And in 1951, a couple of scientists, Doctors Strom and Janssen, wrote a very fascinating article in the Lancet Journal, which is Britain's primary medical journal, where they clearly showed how in Norway, from 1939 to 1945, during the German occupation, the greatest stress, the enemies in your backyard, and yet at that time, on this plant-based type of nutrition, the deaths in Norway from strokes and heart attacks absolutely plummeted.
That's an extraordinarily tight time frame. I mean, it implies that you could radically cut your meat consumption 1 year and the next year improve your survival chances dramatically.
Oh, it's very prompt. It's a very powerful study, and it really the disappointing side of it was as soon as there was a cessation of hostilities in 1949, we had the immediate resumption, of course, of meat and dairy, and back came the strokes and back came the heart attacks within 2 years to what they were in the pre-war era.
What is it, though, about what these products do to the heart that cause it to fail?
Well, the heart itself, the muscle of the heart, which is what comprises our wonderful pump, that's okay. It's the vessels that are going to it that are succumbing to this disease, the blockages and the plaques and so forth.
But what do these products contain?
Well, that's exactly what I want to get into now. What actually we do is we injure the life jacket or the guardian of our blood vessel, which is that tiny little single layer of cells which has a name.
Endothelial cells, right?
That's right, the endothelial cells. And they are
produce nitrous oxide?
No, actually it's close. I have to correct you.
What do they do?
It's nitric oxide.
Thank you.
Nitrous is the laughing gas.
Yes, right. We'd all be a lot happier if we ate
nitrous. Wouldn't it be nice if they would make nitrous? Wonderful.
What does that nitric oxide do?
The endothelial cells make this wonderful nitric oxide, and we like to have nice high levels of that because of the functions that it does for us. Let's take them one by one. First, nitric oxide keeps our blood flowing smoothly, like a Teflon rather than like Velcro. Number two, when we climb upstairs rapidly, the arteries to our heart widen and dilate as do the arteries to our legs. That's due to nitric oxide. Number three, nitric oxide will prevent the formation of inflammation in the walls of our blood vessels. And number four, most importantly, adequate levels of nitric oxide will prevent the formation of plaque or blockages in our artery. And so this is the absolute key, because you can gather from what I've just said earlier that these young GIs who have this coronary artery disease when they lose their lives in combat at age 20, they've already now had their nitric oxide levels lowered so much through the food that they've been eating as they've grown up that they are no longer able to protect themselves from the inception of this disease.
So endothelial cells are disabled and destroyed by what? Fat?
Well, it's
animal protein?
Yeah, the research has gotten sophisticated enough so that we can actually now measure the actual output of nitric oxide indirectly. We can measure this so that we can tell literally within minutes what are the foods that once they pass your lips, within minutes are going to impair, compromise, and injure the endothelial cells so that your ability to make nitric oxide is diminished.
Is this what you call by means of the brachial artery tourniquet test or BART?
You have done your homework.
That seems extraordinary that you can put something in your mouth and almost instantaneously divine its effect.
Well, it's been done very carefully in scientific studies, and we have evolved to the point where we now know that the following foods are those that, when immediately consumed, injure our endothelial cells. They are foods such as the processed oils, olive oil, corn oil, soybean oil, safflower oil, sunflower oil, palm oil, dairy products, yes, milk, cream, butter, cheese, ice cream, yogurt, and, interestingly enough also, anything with a mother, anything with a face, meat, fish, and chicken.
So you're not talking only about fat, because you can get low-fat dairy products, of course, but you're saying that they are still hostile,
They still injure the endothelium, correct.
Mm. Why would we have happily eaten, if not dairy products, that's arguable, why would we have happily eaten meat products for millennia if we weren't supposed to?
Well, I think this is all really a matter of education. I mean, I think, for instance, when you think about the fact that we didn't even know. We thought up until about 1980, we thought that the endothelial cell was just a cute little sort of red brick lining these wonderful pipes, our blood vessels. And now, by 1988, we understood that the endothelial cells were manufacturing this magical product, nitric oxide. The gentlemen who discovered that the endothelial cells made nitric oxide were Drs. Fershkat, Murad, and Ignaro, for which they rightfully received the Nobel Prize in 1998. So it was pretty hard to really do research and wonder why all these years, these common chronic illnesses that we have and sort of blindly accept as sort of a process of aging, really need never occur. We suddenly have now begun to evolve a basis of, really, of scientific understanding.
You realize you're single-handedly going to destroy the New Zealand economy.
Well, you know, I don't think that's really going to happen. I think that,
according to you, we're producing essentially poison that's bringing a premature end to millions of people.
No, I'm confident that New Zealanders will be able to... Suppose that the people who are presently raising the dairy herds and creating these problems were to suddenly use these fields and produce plants that we could eat. I mean, it would be really quite a marvelous turnaround. I mean, New Zealand has done this before, and I'm sure that the remarkable things like this can happen again. But right now, the data is absolutely so overwhelming of the injury that is received to the endothelium from dairy, it's irrefutable.
It seems evolutionarily flawed, however, as so many things do, of course. It's a shonky argument, but we'll go with it for the time being. For example, B12. As far as I know, the only way you can get B12 is from meat. So you would have to be taking B12 supplements, would you not?
You know, it's interesting. If there are some populations where they don't take any B12 supplements, and they're not necessarily deficient, but it's because, let's just say, that their hygiene is somewhat compromised. We ourselves make some B12, but I think rather than compromise on our hygienic efforts, perhaps it is going to be better to take B12. B12 is made by microorganisms in the soil. And, for instance, if you do get it from people who are from animals out of their meat, how do they get it into their meat? By grazing. It's very interesting. No, it's not really a problem to take the B12 supplement.
But doesn't that imply that your diet is inadequate if you must supplement it?
I will respectfully say no. I would disagree there. I don't think it's inadequate at all. I mean, to take a form of food that is documented to cause injury, it's much better perhaps to take the vitamin that if you're not getting it from a toxic source.
Do you take any other supplements?
I do personally take a vitamin D3, 1,000 international units daily, plus about 1,000 micrograms of B12. But I wanted to come back just
a day.
Yes, oh. I wanted to come back just for a moment to the research that we've done, mm-hmm. because I think that there's a very strong message there. For instance, back in 1985 when we started this, the idea was to see if we couldn't take patients who were really quite ill with coronary artery disease. They'd either had their first or second bypass that had failed, they had their first or second angioplasty or stent that had failed, they were too sick for these procedures or they had refused. Five were told that they wouldn't live out the year. Well, all those five made it beyond 20 years, and all the others who were fully compliant had no further progression of their illness. And if you look in some of the photographs in the book, you'll see some striking angiograms, that is, x-rays of their blood vessels to the heart, which will show that we were successful not only in halting the disease, but also there would occasionally be rather striking evidence of regression of the disease.
You mean the endothelial cells build back up again?
You are able to restore the capacity of the endothelial cells to once again make higher and higher levels of nitric oxide, which, as we reported earlier, are so protective to the individual.
I'm talking to Dr. Cordwell Esselstyn about his plant-based diet recommendations. What about the mantra that a lot of people cling to, which is moderation in all things?
Well, you know, it's a little bit like saying, I think I'll just have a few cigarettes, maybe I'll have a small lung cancer, I'll have a little bit of cocaine. It really isn't. Why would you want to take a
small
amount?
You're comparing things that we have been told for years are good for you: olive oil, milk, cheese, moderate amounts of meat. You're comparing those things to nicotine and cocaine?
Well, we have to remember that it doesn't take too long to go back and you will see where doctors were advertising cigarettes, using themselves in those examples.
Well, but the next thing is, you'll be suggesting that the industries that sell these foods that you say are directly causing cardiac disease should be sued. That's the logical outcome.
No, I think that what usually happens to society in these situations is the first thing that happens is there has to be a general overall agreement on the science. Look how long it took us, even after it was absolutely apparent how harmful cigarette smoking was, how long it took to finally get this through and get a Surgeon General statement for that in 1964. I mean, that just took forever.
You are a highly regarded surgeon and medical professional. You're not a food nut, but you're saying something very extreme.
Now, let's talk about that for a minute. What I'm simply saying is that our research has shown that patients who were absolutely at death's door with heart disease could turn this around and really live the rest of their life without having further progression of their disease.
All right.
I don't think that's radical.
Is it like alcohol, for example? There are some people who are predisposed to become alcoholics, and they have to go completely alcohol-free, but the rest of the population can drink small amounts of alcohol. But in order to save the alcoholics, you're suggesting we should all go teetotal.
No, I think that if you recall what I mentioned earlier in our conversation, I made it very clear that we were going to look at the autopsy studies of our GIs in Korea and Vietnam.
It's nothing to do with predisposition, it's everybody.
And more recently, those between the ages of 17 and 34 who died of accidents, homicides, and suicides, where the disease is now ubiquitous. So I'm not of the school that we ought to play brinksmanship with this disease once we absolutely know what are the harmful products. Because the thing that makes this so powerful, quite frankly, is let's suppose that I start with somebody who weighs, let's say, 120 kilo and they've had a heart attack. Either he or she, they get it. Now, at the time that I see them, they also have diabetes. They also have hypertension. They're obese and they're at risk for stroke as well as the heart attack they've had. But they get it. And now, a year later, they weigh considerably less. Their obesity is gone. Their diabetes is gone. Their high blood pressure is gone. And interestingly enough, their likelihood of getting one of the common Western cancers of breast, prostate, and colon is markedly diminished. Their likelihood of getting gallstones is gone. Of diverticulitis is gone. And some of these common autoimmune diseases, rheumatoid arthritis, MS, and lupus, gone. So that when you really look, the thing that makes me so passionate about this, quite frankly, is that if we look at what really has to happen today, we need really a seismic revolution in health. And the seismic revolution in health is never, ever going to come from the invention of another pill. It's not going to come from the invention of another drug, nor another procedure, nor another operation. But the seismic revolution in health is literally at our fingertips if we are able to have the grit and the determination to really make the kind of lifestyle changes that can help this mortal frame endure optimally for the time that we are given on Earth.
It's tempting to see your life as an instructive parable for your position now, given that you were brought up on a beef farm and your father had a fair old multitude of what we would call lifestyle diseases.
Dad was an absolute fossil of the ravages of Western nutrition. Heart attack at 43, became diabetic in his 60s, and then died of metastatic prostate cancer.
All caused by lifestyle, do you
suggest?
There you go. Do you think?
Absolutely.
So, from that point of view, you had a fairly powerful exemplar of how not to eat.
Yes, and you mentioned something earlier that I want to address. You mentioned something about the word extreme. Let's just look at that for a moment, because I'm always...
You know what sparks me to think you're extreme? No nuts, Dr. Esselstyn. One isn't allowed any nuts. I cling to nuts.
I understand. I would say, rather than say extreme, I would say what I'm asking is something which is significant. I'm asking you to have a body of food that is absolutely has tremendous variety and is delicious and will enhance your health, and give up a pile of delicious food that, sadly, is well documented now to injure your health. But let's go back to the extreme for a moment.
There's no replacement for nuts.
Now, when you talk about extreme, just take the States for the moment. We do, 1.2 million stents a year.
Oh, you guys, but you guys,
no,
you
no.
are extreme. You eat far too much.
No, let me finish, because
yes.
I think I want to make 1.2 million stents. Now, what is the mortality when you're doing a stent? Not much, 1%. What's 1% of 1.2 million? 12,000. So 12,000 people die in the States getting their stents. Now, another 500,000 have a coronary artery bypass operation. Mortality is a little higher, 3%. So now there's 15,000 who will die getting their coronary artery bypass. At the time that you get a stent, you're also, there's a some, not again, it's small, a likelihood of having a heart attack, 4%. 4% of 1.2 million, 48,000 heart attacks, and 12,000 deaths. And there's a risk of stroke when you get the bypass. What's the percent there? 6% of 500,000, 30,000 strokes. So we now have a diet that in the United States requires that we have 27,000 deaths. All right. Now we have 48,000 new heart attacks, 30,000 new strokes. That, to me, is a pretty extreme burden to carry. And the real risk of all of this is right now our nation is being pulled into the debtor's prison faster than you can imagine. And the thing that is doing it more quickly than anything else is Medicare. And what is 45% of the cost of Medicare? Cardiology.
Do your colleagues endorse what you're saying? They endorse what you're saying, then why aren't they doing it?
Well, the changes that are this significant move with some degree of caution. But I will answer that by saying that where do you think physicians are coming these days when they develop coronary disease?
What, they're coming to you and saying, please help me get off the nuts?
Yeah.
Are they?
Well, they realize that with the... My big criticism at the present time with the medical profession, quite frankly, is as follows. The data are clear and out there that proof of concept that we can halt this disease has been demonstrated. We have an enormous, enormous amount of money committed to this disease. Let's start at the very beginning. Who doesn't really embrace this change? The United States Department of Agriculture every 5 years puts out a food pyramid on which there will be foods that guarantee that millions of Americans will perish.
Well, we're told that we need a certain amount of fat in the diet. This is a complete lie, you say.
No, I'm not arguing about fat. I'm just talking about plant-based nutrition. If you get into fats, it really gets to be kind of really quite confusing. If you just stick with plant-based, it'll be okay. But I wanted to finish my point about the USDA. So here is a department that is run by, really, the food industry. I mean, in having the USDA make a food pyramid for your culture is like having Al Capone, which was one of our biggest gangsters in Chicago, do your income tax. And there's industry that's against what I'm suggesting. Do you think the $5 billion stent industry or the $25 billion statin industry wants to see this epidemic go away? And even in my own profession, how many cardiac bypass surgeons and interventional cardiologists who do stents are clamoring for fewer and fewer patients?
So is it a conspiracy or is it indifference?
No, it's just a question. Many of these are just absolutely wonderful, wonderful caring clinicians, but they can't quite get their arms yet around the research. They are not really familiar with it yet. They can't believe somehow that one of the most powerful medicines on the planet actually can be food.
I do want to talk about fat for a moment, however, because one of the popular or fashionable food supplements, if you like, at the moment is omega-3. We're told we need omega-3 for all sorts of things to make us
correct
more intelligent, stay
correct
off Alzheimer's,
right.
Blah. You're saying no. No omega-3?
No, I'm not saying that at all. Matter of fact, in the course of our counseling seminar that I have for patients with heart disease, we spend a significant amount of time talking about omega-3. But our omega-3s are largely received through taking a tablespoon of flaxseed meal plus, and here's the place where you really get the wonderful omega-3s, plus the green leafy vegetables. By that I mean things such as, in our country, such as bok choy, Swiss chard, kale, collards, collard green, beet greens, mustard green, turnip greens, napa cabbage, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, cauliflower, cilantro, parsley, spinach, and arugula, and asparagus. And the reason I didn't say romaine was I ran out of breath.
Mm-hmm. Don't you get more omega-3 from a small helping of fish than a giant helping of
mentioned? And now we're back to the animals.
We are.
Yeah, because when you get fish and fish oil, you often don't know if you're getting some mercury and other contaminants. Plus,
that's another issue, though, isn't it?
Yeah, and plus there's recent evidence out of Harvard showing that those who are taking fish and fish oil have a greater tendency to become diabetic. Mm. So it's so much safer, it seems to me, to get the omega-3 through the green leafy vegetables.
So it's not moderation, it's absolute teetotal.
I have a chapter in my book called Moderation Kills, and my point simply is this. If you know that pork chops and steak and hamburgers and cheeseburgers are eliminating and crucifying your endothelial cells, why would you want to have a small heart attack or a small stroke?
You must spend an awful lot of time with your patients trying to help them through the very difficult process of giving up practically everything that you like to eat.
Well, I have an advantage. I think that you can see when patients find us either through the internet or through reading my book, which is called Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease, or they have read the China study by Colin Campbell, who has devoted a chapter or two to what we do. When they find us, they've already had a shot across the bow, to speak. They perhaps have had a heart attack, or they've had a stent, or they've had a bypass. They are suddenly very, very open to some of these significant changes. And right now we're in the process of looking up over another 240 patients that we've treated. And it's so exciting and so heartwarming to think that these patients now fully recognize that they themselves have become the locus of control, not the cardiologist, not the cardiac surgeon, not the pills they're taking, but they themselves have become the locus of control to absolutely annihilate this disease that was destroying them.
Mm. This is not able to be experimented on, I imagine, but I'm just wondering whether it's an attitudinal change that really makes the difference, rather, you know, an empowering attitudinal change, because we know that when people have heart attacks, then they are emotionally disabled in some way.
Well, I think you can answer that by looking at, remember the study I just mentioned of the Germans in World War II. I mean, the Norwegians probably didn't have any great thoughts about anything except surviving. And when they did it through plants, they suddenly found that they had eliminated their strokes and heart attacks. Mm. That's pretty powerful.
Mm. So you think that that eliminates any other cause?
Yeah, I think it makes it pretty compelling.
I'm talking to Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn about a plant-based diet. How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, let's see. I was born in 1933.
All right. You were obviously a fit person your whole life.
I've always felt that it was important to exercise, but food trumps it all. Yes, I like my patients to walk and to think about exercise, but I will never, never, never want them to have the feeling that they can work out and somehow run down their cholesterol levels and avoid any calamity if they're strenuously exercising. That doesn't help. I mean, that doesn't compute.
Have you struck people for whom a plant-based diet does not cure their heart ailments and their cholesterol levels?
In other words, if somebody is fully compliant, how many failures have we had?
Okay.
Is that a fair...
That'll do.
Okay. In over the last 26 years, I can say, honestly, there has been one. And I was so puzzled by this that was just recently, that I've actually have gone to the person's house to look at the refrigerator, inspect the cabinets, and I think we can, how will I say this, I think we can tighten it up a little bit better, but I was a little bit disappointed.
They were cheating.
No, not really. I just think it could have been a lot better. It couldn't have been, but I'm going to say that was a failure on my part.
Not to monitor them sufficiently, you mean?
Yes.
All right. Did they die?
Oh, no.
He's checking.
No, he's still, he's doing well.
All right. So you managed to get him back on the wagon,
yes,
as it were. One of the interesting points you make, and it relates back to your comparison, I think, of bad food being like, you know, a drug like nicotine or cocaine, is that we do develop a dependency on it. We develop I suppose, receptors that welcome fat, and when the fat's taken away, we crave it. Is there some way that you recommend people get over that?
Yes, you know, I think you've made an absolutely excellent point.
It's because of my attachment to nuts. I know.
Well, there is a wonderful research center in Philadelphia called the Monell Chemical Senses Center. And what I'm about to share with you is having to do with what you've just mentioned, namely that just as we have receptors in our brain for cocaine, heroin, and nicotine, we have receptors in our brain for fat. And the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia did a very interesting study to see how long it would take to downregulate the fat receptor. And they took people who were getting 34% fat in the diet, 20% fat in the diet, and then about 11%, which is where our patients are. And they found out that at the end of 12 weeks, 90 days, that is to say 3 months, only one of those groups had downregulated their fat receptor to the point where they were no longer craving fat, and that was our group at close to 11%. And so the honest answer I would share with you would probably be what they found by research, which was about 90 days, 12 weeks, or 3 months. But we have seen many patients, just from our clinical experience, where that happens in a much quicker time than that.
What do you think you'll die of, if you don't mind me asking? What do you think?
Well, I think that one of the things, if we look at any of the people who have been on plant-based, you certainly are not going to have to worry about not dying. I mean, we've had some patients who died of the smattering of diseases that we really fully don't understand. We've had some patients who have succumbed from pulmonary fibrosis. We've had some patients succumb from amyloid disease, which are both very, very infrequent and rare. We've interestingly enough, we've not had any patient in our original small group of 24 that is over 20 years. We've not seen any cancers in that group.
Cautious on this point, aren't you?
I'm very cautious about saying.
Why are you more cautious about that than you are about heart disease?
Well, I think the study is too small, but the diet that we're suggesting, from all the work that has been done on research in cancer, it certainly supports the identical type of diet because it appears that somehow animal protein is a very, very strong promoter for cancer. For instance, if we recognize the fact, let's just say, for example, if you were to autopsy and look at the prostate gland of 100 Japanese men at age 50 and 100 U.S. men at age 50, you'd find the same amount, that 50% already had a very, very early, small, non-invasive cancer of the prostate gland. I mean, these are people who have died of auto accidents and the like. Mm. But the interesting thing is that what happens over the next 10, 15, or 20 years, there'll be a much more significant number of the U.S. men who will now develop invasive prostate cancer, whereas in the Japanese, in Japan, that is, it will remain this sort of early, indolent, in situ, non-invasive type right up into their 80s and 90s. Mm. And the implication here is that it is the animal protein which serves as the promoter of this illness into a more aggressive type.
Do you drink alcohol as a matter of interest?
Yeah. I'm quite modestly, maybe once a week, a little glass of beer.
All right. I need to know what you would eat of an evening without nuts.
One of our favorite meals, actually, when we first really started getting interested in this.
You're going to mention lentils at this point. I know you are.
Beans and rice are a real backbone of this, and they are terrific because what you can do is you put the beans on top of the rice after they've been cooked, and then on top of the beans you have all this whole panoply of cut-up vegetables with cut-up tomatoes, corn, some peas. They can be cut-up peppers, water chestnuts, scallions, and you have then sprinkle just lightly a little what we call low-sodium tamari, a type of, or you can use salsa.
Oh, Lord, that's right, because salt's gone as well.
and you can have salsa, and it's just an absolute treasure. Another thing we've come to enjoy with, we've got some wonderful pizza crusts that have now been made with whole grains, or you can do it with rice. And the cheeseless pizza where you just pour on every imaginable vegetable when you, and it's just delicious. And then there can be all different types of preparations you can do and stir fry in the wok with that you can put on the grain, whether it's couscous, quinoa, or wheat berries, rye berries, and the like, barley. It's really what we need here is my beloved wife Anne, who did all the 150 recipes in the book, and it's really made it very easy for patients who, when they like a puppy in the deep grass, when they first start this, they can suddenly get their feet solidly under them and know how to move forward.
I take it that the whole family went onto a plant-based diet.
You know, it's very interesting. Yes, our children now are grown, and they have we have 8 grandchildren, and all the family and the grandchildren eat this way.
Thank heavens! Otherwise, you'd never get together for Christmas, would you?
You know, but I, without trying to be too boastful about it, some people are worried about where they're going to get their protein. Well, my good friend Colin Campbell, who wrote the China Study, one of America's premier nutritionists, clearly, it's impossible to be protein deficient if you're eating the variety of the plant-based foods, all the whole grains for your cereal, bread, and pasta, 101 different types of legumes, all the different red, yellow, and green leafy vegetables and fruit. I mean, it's there are bodybuilders and champion athletes eating plant-based all the time.
Do you feel as if this is the diet of the future?
You know,
you obviously feel it should be, but do you think it will be?
Well, you remember now, I grew up on an Aberdeen Angus beef farm,
yeah,
and a dairy farm.
Did you not inhale meat? I mean, did you not?
Oh, sure.
So you've managed, as you say, to reverse the damage that you would claim was done to you at an early age on account of all the beef.
I don't know. I've done this now for 26 years that I've been eating this way.
Mm.
And I feel that it has helped considerably. When I think of my father, who at 43 had his first heart attack, that really put me in sort of a pretty strong risk situation when you have a first degree relative under the age of 50 who has a heart attack. So, yeah, I feel that I've been able to construct a lifestyle that has saved me from that similar fate.
Have tests shown you good news about the workings of your heart and everything else?
Well,
in other words, have you got a clean bill of health?
I will share with you that I recently had, just because my research is exposing me so much to the, shall we say, to parties who would like to really know exactly what my inner workings are about.
Yeah.
And is this guy just full of baloney or what? I went to our Department of Cardiology and I went ahead and I had a, what we call a stress echo. That is a test which really will detect any weakness in your cardiac situation. And it consists of the following. They have a cot where you lie down and you have a ultrasound probe that is placed over your heart in multiple different positions. And then immediately next to the cart, they have the sort of the stress gadget that you walk on, the treadmill. And you also are set up to an electrocardiogram. So at the time you're walking on this treadmill, their goal is to take you to your maximum pulse that you can possibly get and stress you out as much as they can under these very safe conditions. And I went all the way to the top of and beyond for my age group, and then they immediately lay you down again and again with the ultrasound probe. And now they're measuring your heartbeat where it's going maximally to see if there are any deficits. And I'm proud and happy to say that apparently this plant-based nutrition has made it so that there are, at the present time, no deficiencies in my heart when it's fully stressed out.
Well, I hope you continue to live a long and fulfilling life.
I think there's a lot to go. The reason I'm so passionate now, even though I was, I never thought after I retired from surgery, when I started surgery, I never thought when I retired from surgery that I would be continuing in medicine. But I must say that when my research began to sprout wings, it was pretty impossible to give up, because I feel that, as I said earlier, we are at the cusp of what could really be a seismic revolution in health. And I think one of the things that is going to really propel that forward is knowledge that is evidence-based research. And we're about to report our next last 250 patients, which I think will make a much more significant number. Those who have decried the fact that our numbers were small originally when we demonstrated and proved the concept that this was correct, now that the numbers are larger, it's going to be very difficult for people to refute that.
And this will include animal protein and fat.
Well, I mean,
you're testing for...
We're testing without animal protein and fat. That is correct.
Okay. You don't know which is the most serious culprit, the animal protein or the animal fat?
Well, let's just say that at the present time...
You think I'm splitting hairs here, don't you?
A piece of muscle, whether it paws with a hoof, whether it flaps a wing, or whether it wiggles a fin, all muscle is made up of animal protein, animal cholesterol, and animal fat, none of which I want you to have.
Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn.